This is the Real Ass Podcast. Here's your host, Luis J. Gomez.
What is up, Real Ass fans? We are back with another edition of the Real Ass Podcast. I'm your host, Luis J. Gomez, Real Ass Dude, Puerto Rican Rattlesnake, Howard Stern of MMA Radio, coming at you live from Nashville, Tennessee. Yet another Real Ass Podcast exclusive. I'm very excited to have this guest on today. Very good friend of mine, hilarious comedian, just an overall good guy. Godfather to my son, little known fact. The one and only, the hilarious, the original sniper, Nate Bargatze.
Are you, you named yourself the Howard Stern of MMA Radio? Are you the...
Yeah, no, I did name myself that. Yeah, that was me. There's been a few other names that have been given to me that I've taken.
Any of them, the ones you just named? Puerto Rican Rattlesnake?
No, I made that one up.
All right. Real ass dude?
No, that was... Somebody called me a real ass dude, and I was like, that's good. That's a good thing right there. Yeah. And that started it all off. Julian Vance, hilarious comic, called me a real ass dude once, and you can blame him if you have any problems with any of my nicknames, Nate.
Yeah. No, I like them.
Yeah. So, look, I'm hanging out with you. We just did a weekend over in Cincinnati, Ohio. Go Bananas.
Yes.
Lots of fun.
Yeah.
I very in often get to open up for you because we do have such different comedic styles.
That's not why.
What do you mean? Yeah, that is why.
I don't think someone's telling you no.
Well, no, you're not saying no. I'm just saying it's not. Look, it's not.
You opened for my special.
I did open for your special, but I have to alter who I am a little bit as a performer in order to really set you up. Here's the thing.
And the key word was little bit. Little bit. That's the key word. You think you can be... It was almost like, look, if you're not into... There's clean comedy, there's dirty comedy. And I don't care. I like a lot of dirty. I think Lewis is very funny. You know, Big J. Everybody's dirty is funny. I have no problem with it. I am clean. And so... I would be like, hey, maybe just don't go, you know, this isn't like, don't be as hard, maybe. And you always tell me how clean you are.
I never say I'm clean.
Yes, you do. You tell me. You call me. You'll tell me I've got a clean set. This is all clean.
I say I've got a new clean joke. I get excited about it. I feel like you, you're one of the only good, I shouldn't say that at all. I say you're one of the only young guys that are like a coming up hot comic that people are talking about that's clean. Like it's almost, it's not even, people don't even notice that you are squeaky clean.
Yeah,
like,
but that's the goal. You don't want anybody to.
Yeah, nobody, you, yeah. When you say that you're clean to people, they go, oh, is he? And then they go, oh, I guess he is. But literally everything you write can be done on network television.
Yeah.
So when I come up with a clean concept or if I do a, you know, if I put together a clean tape, I get excited and I go to you and I say, hey, dude, I got this new clean bit or I have this new clean tape that I'm putting together and I kind of want to get your approval because you're the dude that everybody respects that is clean.
Yeah. It's, no, and I appreciate that, but it's, no, I know, I'm joking with you, but it was funny to see, I mean, you try to go clean this, you know, this weekend. It was not the super easiest for you. And
it's
you only had one show. You still cussed in every show.
No, there was one show. Saturday. Actually, you want to how much you want to bet? Because I have the tape of the one show that I didn't curse in.
And here you go. We're going to listen to all of them. it's 2.5 hours of comedy.
Dude, I started the one show that I didn't curse at all in. I taped, and the reason I know I didn't curse in it is because it was such a good set that I was like, holy shit, I can use this as maybe a half-hour submission. So I didn't curse on the one show. And also, by the way, the host was cursing.
He's not my responsibility, like I told you. My responsibility is the Puerto Rican rattlesnake. That's who I have to answer for. No one answer. No one cares.
But, I mean, no, look, the truth of the matter is I don't open for you as often as I would have over the years because it's just stylistically speaking, like, I come at him and I'm saying fuck and I'm cursing and I have rape jokes.
You make everything the Luis J. Gomez show. That's what you make everything. You do. I wouldn't even know we were going to talk about this, but we're going to talk.
Let's
make
talk about
everything
it.
The Luis J. Gomez show.
I want to hear it. What do you mean?
Everything you do is it's all about you. You're there. It's your show. It's not my show.
That's not true.
I'm headlining for Luis J. Gomez.
It was your show.
No, it's not my show.
Did you see the one person wrote on my Facebook wall, I'm going to go see Luis J. Gomez? And then they tagged me, and then they wrote feature for Nate Bargatze, but you weren't even tagged. It was like my show they were excited about.
Yeah. No, that's fine. I got paid more money, so.
You got paid substantially more money.
What's the one thing you did? You buying that girl a drink when it was her birthday. That's a perfect example of if you're...
I didn't buy it, by the way. Huh? I just say that. I never get the drink.
Yeah, because you're the middle act. You can't even do that.
No, I don't have enough money.
No, but that was like... I heard you. It's such a Luis J. Gomez thing. And you're the only one that does this. And I know you're going to do it. And it makes me laugh. I'm not saying that I don't sit back there and laugh. And I laugh, I think, like, if it wasn't you, I would probably be pretty upset.
If it was just some dude.
But, like, Luis will go on and just, like, you know, everything's like, oh, you got to talk to the crowd, obviously, like, talking to everybody. And then, like, some girl in the back, what's going on, sweetheart? Like, that's Luis. What's going on, sweetheart? What are you guys celebrating something? Yeah, it's her birthday. Oh, darling, it's her birthday. Let me buy you a drink, darling. Let me buy you a drink. And you're like, this is the middle act. This is the guy that's in this. We're not even here to see. I mean, we're not to see anybody, really, probably. No one's there to see either one of us. Like, they're just in it because it's a comedy club. But... this is like the middle act going, hey, come on, let me, what do you guys want? You guys want a round of drinks? Guys, get a round of drinks. Everybody gets a round of drinks on me, on the kid.
But hold on now, could you imagine in the audience's mind, okay, they're watching me and they're going like, holy shit, this is just the middle act? I can only imagine the type of personal relationship and magic that the headliner is going to bring to this show.
Zero.
I feel like it's setting you up even more.
It's zero because I don't talk to them. I don't talk to them at all. I just do an act.
But isn't that the point I'm trying, when I preface this conversation with, I'm not a very good opener for you, because stylistically speaking, I have limitations, Nate, okay? I am the type of comic that I am, and a while ago, you know, maybe a year ago, or maybe a year or two ago, I just said, all right, well, I shouldn't put myself into situations where I can't be comfortable and be me. So... I got offered a gig recently, a college gig. They were like, yeah, dude, can you do an hour clean? Two grand. I've never been paid $2,000 to do comedy in my life, dude. Can you do an hour clean? And I was like, no, I just can't do it. I was like, I can get another comic to do a half an hour. I'll do a half an hour. I got 15 minutes clean.
You're going to do, which we can talk about the other college we did. Go ahead. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
But I turned it down.
Yeah.
And the guy wrote me back. He was like, you know, most people wouldn't have been honest. I really appreciate your honesty. And I was like, all right, that's, you know, I think that's a better way to kind of run your career. Mm-hmm. Now, this guy's never called me for another gig ever.
I know. He never
not
will.
Once. It's over. Like,
that's cool that you're really honest. You will not work ever again.
You will never work with us ever. But like, I don't really put myself in those situations. So with you, like, no, the only reason I would come and open up for you is because I want to hang out with you and I want to fucking come out and have a good time. We don't get to see each other that often. So I will alter my act a little bit. And I did alter my act. It's a way cleaner version of me.
No, I know.
Substantially cleaner.
But it's not a bad thing. Like, you shouldn't, like, what is it crazy for you to go do that? Like, just go try to be, I mean, if you want to put stuff on TV, you're going to have to be able to do this. You have to be able, and it's the thing that I've always told you, you should try to stop cussing in life, because you're going to, like, the biggest fear of what you have, you will let stuff slip out. And, like, so that's, like, the biggest risk of some, like, if you are dirty and not dirty, I think you got to have the control of it to, like, not, like, let stuff slip. So, like, you should use a weekend like that. I mean, I think you already think you know how to do comedy. We've talked about that. So you don't, but you should... you should learn, like, it's like, just like, so there's just some control of it, because it's like, I think you will slip and let something slide.
By the way, I've been on terrestrial radio, I've been on network TV, having to do a network TV clean set, I've been on other showcases where I can't be dirty, where I'm showcasing for NBC Santa for Diversity, Comedy Central. I've never let it slip. I've never messed up once. But like,
well, where was that this weekend then?
That wasn't slipping. That was me. No, there was, look, the last show, Sunday night.
You did. You calmed.
Some rowdy assholes in the crowd.
Yes.
And the truth is, I had to turn in to me. I had to, like, let go and hammer them a little bit because they were being fucking assholes. And that's where I slipped. When I say, quote unquote, slip, it's like, no, I just stopped trying to do my jokes in a clean way. You know what I'm saying?
I was fine with, like, that, because that was awful.
Yeah, there was a couple up front in the show, and it's so funny, because this is what happens on, like, not weekend nights at comedy clubs where they have extra seats. There's a bar right next door to the comedy club, and the comedy club is awesome. I will say, so appreciative of the fact that you brought me there, and there's such a cool staff. The owner of the place is awesome. The manager was awesome. Really great club. But they have a bar right next door. So I'm assuming on a Sunday or a Thursday where they have extra seats available, they'll go over to the bar and be like, hey, there's some seats if you guys want to come over, you know, come over and check out a comedy show. So there was like a middle-aged, not even couple. They were just two singles.
Yeah.
Which are just the worst, like two 45-year-old single
they
people.
They were on a blind date.
They were on a blind date.
That's what they said. They met on the internet or something.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. But they were hanging out at that bar.
Yeah, and they were getting along.
They were loving
it. They met as a date and then were getting to find out two booze bags that got together.
And they couldn't have been any more interested in each other. It was actually really, like, refreshing when you see a couple that they're talking and they're so into each other. They really wanted to just be together and they really wanted to learn about each other. But they were in the fucking front row at a comedy club.
Yeah.
So they took that conversation from the bar and they just continued it in the front row. Yeah. Like, there was nothing going on.
Nothing going on.
So, yeah, I let go a little bit, and I started hammering them a little bit, and I said fuck at one point while I was hammering them. But
you say it more than you realize. But you do, like, that's fine. You said it, and I was fine with it. You said it throughout the weekend. Don't act like this was, that guy
I
pulled it out of
me. I said it.
The point is, all I'm trying to make is quit acting like you're, like, you know, it's like, you say it, however many times you think you say it. You're three more times than that.
Maybe, but in all honesty,
because that's how much you say. But I think that's it's the way you talk. It's the way New York talks. It's what New York is, and that's it's completely different. I remember being in New York and hearing kids just unreal, like on a subway, like a 12-year-old kid, just the mouth, and I was like blown away because you're just like, how do you talk? But then I realized it's like that's just what it is. Cussing is completely different. In different areas. So it's like, I understand. It's what it is. My point with you is just, it's harder than you think. And then I think you say it more than you think. But I wasn't mad. I wasn't like, fine.
No, I know. Look, believe me.
But the worst part was when we tried to sell CDs, and then you're just an animal. And I'm like, these people are like, it's like, we've already talked about being clean. And then when we go sell CDs, I mean, unbelievable. You're just yelling at them. Like, but not like, I just love, I'm not making fun of you, but it's like funny to be like, this is the exact same audience that we were just talking about being in clean. It's not different people.
You're right.
We're not in a different place.
I have a difficult time putting a filter or a muzzle on myself. I always have. And in all honesty, I've kind of embraced that. That I'm going to say quality in me, and I use that as part of who I am as a comedian and as a radio personality. You know, it's just about playing your cards. That's just one of my cards. I'm going to always kind of be a loudmouth and obnoxious and use dirty language. That's kind of who I am. And for a long time in the industry, I wasn't sure of who I was, and I tried to be somebody else. I tried to play the game way too much, like literally up until like a year ago. One year ago, after the last Comic Standing experience, I just said, all right, dude, I would rather just be me. I don't try to write clean jokes anymore. There was a while I was like, oh my God, I really got to try to write clean jokes. And it just wasn't working. So now I'll just write, and one out of every five jokes I write ends up being clean. And it's just a better process. So what you're talking about is me just kind of being a little bit more comfortable being me. You're right. It works in a negative way. There's going to be a time where I'm in a room. I remember one time I filmed, Jermaine Fowler did a Fox web series.
Yeah.
And I walked in, dude. And I know all the comics. It's all comics that I know. We're all just buddies. So I don't even remember the joke. I mean, I just made some rape joke. I said something about rape. And Jermaine like pulled me aside. He was like, dude, this is the real industry. You can't just make rape jokes. It was actually a lesson learned in that moment. He's like, they don't know you. Like, I know you.
This happened in like, I picture like, just a pit bull running into a room, and you're the pit bull, and then the owner has to come in and go, "Cuz, I'm really sorry about that. Yeah, he just got completely loose from me. I thought he was on the loose."
Just fucking a gutted chihuahua. Dude, I'm so sorry. Sometimes he just murders chihuahuas.
Yeah. They'll never forget that pit bull. But I mean, they probably can't use him.
He's
they
gonna
can't
stand use him. Out in their mind forever.
He'll stand out in their mind forever. They can't use him for anything because he's a wild card. Look, it's fine. Look, this is the Lewis that I love. This is, and you're, I would always bring you Just because, yeah, so we can hang out on the road. And I'm you know, it's like...
We also have a good 15 minutes on what an animal I am, so it does work well. Yeah. Did you do the bit about me getting out to fight the dudes? Remember when Laz at Stand Up New York was getting into a fight?
No, I almost did. I never really said that was you in the joke.
Yeah.
I might bring that joke back because someone needs some material. I don't know if that made it. I don't know if that made it anywhere. It was you and Dave Smith.
Yeah.
And then, but that's, yeah. So I don't, yeah, there's not, I don't want to come off like I'm giving you, it's like,
no, I mean,
you
know,
but I think when I, like, when we do go on the road, it's like, we are different. It's going to be like, I will always ask you to be like, hey, just maybe.
No, obviously, look, I have a ton of like really filthy shit. If I get them going, let's say I do my job, it's my job to kill. Okay. As a comics, it's our job to come out and kill and get the audience laughing as much as possible and get them in a great mood. But if I get them, if I'm murdering with, you know, cunt and rape and fuck Joe, and like I'm doing all this stuff, and they're like, wow, dude, we love this. We are in the mood for this. This is what we want. And then you switch over and you're doing these smart observational jokes and this, like, I get how that isn't most conducive for your act. The same way that if I'm, you know, if I go on the road, if I were to bring a super political dude to come and open, I mean, I saw Jay do that all the time with Dave Smith.
You're just naming Dave Smith.
I can't. Dave wouldn't be my.
I don't want to say his name, but like, say a real political comedian. I don't want to say his name, but if I brought a real political comedian, and you know, maybe the other guy is a bigger guy that does a lot of dirty jokes.
It's not going to work as much. There's going to be people in the audience that go like, "I mean, this guy was doing this heady, smart shit, and now this guy's fucking coming up here just talking about rape."
The microphone tackling brings the guy on stage and tackles him. He makes the guy in the front row put him in an arm bar so he can show the audience that he can get out.
Dude,
I want you to start doing that stuff.
Dude, I threatened that guy in the front row last night. He made me so angry.
Oh, it's crazy. You go, don't look at me. Don't look at my face. I will murder you.
He started getting tough with me. I was like, I said something, and then he kind of like made like a face like he was tough in front of the chick. And I'm like, dude, you're a 45-year-old guy from fucking Ohio.
Why did you talk to him afterwards and like give him a hug?
Because he came up to me afterwards and was like, I'm sorry. What was I supposed to do? I don't hold any ill will for the guy afterwards. And by the way, he also shut up. Here's the thing.
He shut up, but he talked to me. I had to address him too.
Here's the thing. They weren't malicious people that were trying to be dicks. They weren't heckling. They just didn't know any better. If you weren't in
which is the worst. I know, if you're not even in the comedy world, if you're at a movie and you were talking like that, nothing in your head registers that you're like, hey, I guess this probably isn't the best place to talk. If you're walking, like we walk down the mall and you're talking very loud and like, where it's like, so I get more uncomfortable than most people. But it's like, there's always like, you don't have any self-awareness that you're not the only person in it. I'm not saying that exists, but like even the movie, like if you go to a movie and talk, if you go anywhere where people are being quiet and then you're talking, if you go to a library and have a conversation, they'd be like, oh, I just don't ever go to the library, so I didn't know that I'm not supposed to just have a full-on loud conversation. There's a point where those people are like, you're completely in the wrong. You've ruined the show. You may just had a miserable time. And at the end of it, you're like, hey, I'm sorry.
Here's the thing. You're right. But they weren't completely the example of that. Like, if they just did it obnoxiously those times and said, fuck you, and they just were never kicked out, and they were just that the whole
they
time.
They did it to a point that you threatened to murder him.
Yeah, and at that point, he shut the fuck up. At that point, he stopped doing it.
Yeah.
So if it comes to a point where I say, hey, be quiet, they eventually got that, no, it wasn't cool. They got it. It wasn't like when the person from the club came over to them, I addressed them, you addressed them.
They ruined a joke I had. Like, I completely had to get out of it.
But you don't understand the thing where I'm not going to walk out of there going, fuck those people. If the guy comes up to me and says, hey, dude, I'm really sorry. I wasn't trying to ruin your act. Like, I think you're great. You guys were really funny. I'm not going to go like, well, fuck you. But like, you know, look, I've said fuck you to plenty of people after a show. People come over and be like, yeah, you know, it just wasn't very professional of you to say that. I'm like, go fuck yourself. Are you crazy? I did a joke about, I said something about pussy cancer, and this one girl started hysterically crying because I guess her friend died of pussy cancer, and she came up to me after the show, she ruined the rest of my set, like just came up to me after the show. I was like, I don't care that your friend died. I was like, I'm actually happy your friend died now, because this is the fucking person you are. Go fuck yourself. I don't have any part of me that's just like, whatever, I'm going to be cool to a person. No, but he wasn't that much of a problem. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I mean, he technically was, but yes. I mean, like, if you can go from 1 second to saying you're going to murder a guy to the next, like, the guy's all right.
Like, yeah, but it's part of the shit. It's also, look, when somebody heckles me or somebody does that, I will go there. Like, your threshold for saying I'm going to go murder that guy is a way different threshold than mine.
It is.
It is. Yeah. So you're going to, for you to say to an audience member, hey, dude, if you don't shut the fuck up, I'm going to drop this microphone and kick your cup into your mouth.
He might have to be physically hitting.
I mean, yeah, he's going to have to, like, he's going to have your daughter by, like, like gunpoint, or, like, it's going to have to be a thing.
Yeah.
For me, it literally takes twice. Two times of them interrupting with even a whisper. I'm just going to go there. But that's part of my, I don't want to say shtick, because it's not like a shtick. Like, that's part of my personality and who I am. So 99% of the time, the audience is laughing and they're with it. Not last night's audience. That was pretty funny.
Well, they, yeah. Last night's audience was just trying to get, I mean, honestly, it was just trying to get through it. Like, I was by, when I went up, I was already annoyed. And then, because that's the thing, it derails the show. Like, to, like, them talking at the beginning like that can make it so bad. And I really had, like, one of my new jokes that I wanted to say, because I was going to try to switch something around, you know, whatever, like, thing I was trying to do. And, like, they just, they talk right in the middle of it. You have to stop it. And then now I got to get out of the joke. Now I'm actually kind of off on my set, because you're, like, trying to, like, figure out kind of where you're at. And then you, like, got to get back in it. And, like,
and people don't understand how sensitive comedy is. You know, it's, there, if there's, if you're in a room, right, and then a light starts flickering in the corner,
yeah.
If you're in a comedy room, the whole show's done.
Yeah.
Everyone is gone, dude. If yeah. there's, like, let's say a light bulb just starts flickering at yeah. the bar, whatever it is, you know what I'm saying? That little distracting light bulb, no matter how much people are, you're trying to get them in the moment, they're just there. They're taking, the, even yeah. if it's just 10% out of it and their attention is taken a little away, you can't connect with people that way.
Yeah.
That's why bar shows are really difficult, because you have, like, there's people at the bar talking, you have, you know, music upstairs, you kind of hear that thumping or whatever, and it's a difficult environment to get, to really connect with an audience with.
Yeah.
An audience has to be there because they really want to be there for comedy. And that's when you get amazing moments in comedy. There's so many clubs in New York, or there's so many bar shows, or so many clubs around the country where they paper the room. The people aren't really into the... That was those two people. Last night at, yeah. at Bananas, they weren't there for a comedy show. They went to a bar for a blind date, and they said, fuck it, let's go to a comedy show, see what happens. They didn't care.
Yeah, you wish you could... Yeah. I think you could always, too, like, with comedy clubs. I think... I bet I could sit at the door and pick out 90% of the people that would be a problem.
Yeah.
If not more than 90. Well, and I could stop them before they go in and go, we think you're going to be a problem, so you can't come in.
I do that all the time. I'll be at a comedy club, but I'll be like, oh, I know they're going to be a problem.
I called it at Eastville once.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Like, when a guy had he wasn't even in the door.
The guy from the Jets?
No. That guy ended up being huge. and that guy could do whatever he wants. Like, if you told that guy you were going to murder, he'd be like, I would love it. I would love for you to try
bring
to murder.
It, motherfucker. Yeah.
He was in his prime condition.
Oh my God.
Starting for the Jets.
Yeah, now he's been injured a couple times. I think I could take him now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but he's still like...
Dustin Keller, if you're out there, bring it.
Louis J. Gomez will fight you.
Yeah, I'll say it. I have no fear.
Yeah?
I have no fear. Yeah. No, are you kidding me? He'd fucking murder me. I don't know if I told that story in a podcast, but I almost got into a fight with Dustin Keller once at a comedy club, who was like a tight end for the Jets, and he fucking grabbed me by my arm.
And he went to Miami, too.
Oh, yeah, he's been all, like, over the place.
No, Miami, I think it's Miami Hurricanes, I think, is where he, like, so, like, I'm just saying, like, Miami Hurricanes, their football players also tend to be, like, just crazier.
He's just a big, scary dude, and he grabbed me by my arm and told me to apologize to his girlfriend, and then I said no, and then he just jerked me, and I was like, oh, man, that's going to be a problem.
I mean, he moves around guys bigger than you, like, just on the field.
But what happened at Eastville that you called?
I called a guy right when he walked in. I go, that guy's going to be a problem. You can tell immediately. Goes in. Guy was a nightmare during the whole show. Started yelling at me. And then I told him I was more happy about going, dude, I said you were going to be a nightmare 2 hours ago.
Cut to 3 years later. That was Louis J. Gomez. Yeah. That's how we met.
Cut to 3 years later. Open for me. Go for next. Still can't be clean. Still can't.
you are a clean comic. But you, I think there's this debate in the comedy world. Clean versus dirty. I think the general consensus is that it's a lot harder to be clean, but I don't like when people say that it's like just a cheap laugh. When you say fuck, it's just a cheap, easy laugh. Look, let me tell you something. Put somebody up there who's not a skilled comic, You can give them every word in the book, and 99% of comics in every scene do use every word in the book, okay? Yeah. So if it was so easy to make people laugh with curse words, why are there so many shit comics that bomb and eat their dick off with it? It's just, it's not, you have to learn how to use your words.
I think everybody's goal should be that you don't notice what they are. That's, I think, that's my goal is, I don't want you to be there. I don't want you to, like, you know, it's like, if someone gets advertised as, like, this guy's a clean comic. There's a lot of people that come for that. But I don't want to people that are like would just see clean comedy and then they associate that with bad comedy and then they're not going to come. So my goal is to like, and I think every comedian should be, even if you're dirty clean, just should be, I don't want to be either one of those things. I just want to be funny and I want you to come and not like, you know, I mean, you shouldn't like, I don't know, if you're going to comedy to like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. If you're going to comedy just because you want the guy to be dirty, it's like, then you're like, I don't know. It's like, to me, you should just be able to go and like enjoy, like, if anybody's funny, whether he's dirty or clean, as long as it's funny, it's like, that's all that matters. You know?
Do you think it's easier to be dirty than clean though?
No, I don't. I think my brain works differently. My brain works in a cleaner way. Since I've never said cuss words on stage, like, you know, not that I haven't, but like, I've had jokes where the cuss word was like, would get the laugh, and that would make, like, because then I gotta get rid of that. I gotta figure out how to make, like, that's the only reason that joke's getting the laugh. And I'm not saying that's the only reason anybody's does. I mean, I think you cuss so much that it doesn't, you might as well, you know, you're almost clean because you're using, there's no shock. There's no shock. There's no, like, you know, it's not like, well, just because you said that, you're funny. It's like, well, he said it, you said it 50 times before that. It's just how you talk. And so I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it matters. My brain works differently. The only good thing I think that I've liked that it's helped, to be honest, is like being clean is I think sometimes I will go a different way than maybe a lot of people might go.
Well, I think I think what makes it easier when you curse or forget curse, when you do an act out, when you emote a lot with your hands, when you move around a lot on stage, it's an exclamation point. It's a fucking, let me hit you. Let me, you know, having mic diction. When you move the mic closer or further away from yourself because you're raising your voice, there's all of these little subtle things that can be used to get the biggest possible laugh out of the audience. So when I use a curse word, typically I'm just talking how I talk. You know what I'm saying? But if a lot of times you'll just say something like, you know, let's say the line is, so I went to the car, or you say, I went to the fucking car. Like that fucking, it's a punch and it hits them. And you're right, you know, it becomes like a thing. Well, do I need that fuck? Is it funny without the fuck? No, maybe it's not a joke then. But it's still our job to just entertain. So if the guy's entertaining and the word fuck makes him entertain that crowd that much more than the guy who didn't use it, is it any more wrong or any more right, you know?
I think it's, you know, I don't even know what you were talking about there.
That was a lot of words. It was a lot of words.
It's look, if you need, you know, I mean, like, if you need that cuss, you know, it's like I said, you talk like Jay, like, it's like you're very dirty, like, where it's like, you are cussing, but it's like you're doing it so much that you're not even relying. The cuss word is not the thing that gets the laugh. Because if it was, I mean, it can't be. For a cuss word to get a laugh is like you're specifically putting cuss words like into, like, they're at a place in the joke for that specific reason. That's why it gets a laugh. Because you're making a point with it. But if you're cussing throughout your entire set because it's just the way you talk, then that's not helping you. Because now you're doing it so much, so like the audience is getting desensitized to like you even hearing that word. So with you cussing, like, as long as you did, like, it's not going to matter as much because, I don't know, you've said that word 50 times. So then if you try to say it at the end to like get a laugh, it's like, I've just heard you say it 100 times. And maybe if you did say it, then I'm just saying, I don't think you're using those words to get a laugh. I think that's how you talk, and I think your joke, I think if you cuss so much, then your joke is almost literally like being clean in a way. Because you're just, you know, whatever little angle you would have to give you a lift over the edge. You know, I don't know. That doesn't even make sense either.
It makes sense. No, it does make sense. I agree with you. You said this to me a while ago. I don't even know if it's true anymore. There was a while where you had never even cursed on recording.
I still don't know if I have.
Not even on a podcast?
I'm trying to think. I don't think, you know, I mean, I said real ass dude to start this.
That's a big one.
That's a big one.
That's a big one. The first guys, we broke records. Nate Bargatze's first.
Yeah.
Yeah, curse word.
I'm forced to because your whole life has...
Say fuck right now. Just for me. Once on. Come on, just once.
Your whole life is cuss words. I can't do anything with you that is not involved with your title of it. I have to say, here we go. No, I honestly don't think I have. Like, but you know, it's almost come a point to like where it's almost like a game now where I just don't, you know. I don't want to. Look, people, I don't know. It's like, I just don't want to. Like, it's like, the way I look at it is like, I don't want to. Like, people cuss. You got enough people cussing. Why do you need me to do it too? Like, I'm not doing it because I think I'm better than anybody. I'm just doing it maybe to like, it makes me be a little different than something else.
Well,
like,
also look, like, it does open up a lot of opportunities for you as a comic. You know, I think, look, if you can be funny, if it's
my,
you.
My best friends are the filthiest comedians in the world.
100%. All the guys you hang out with, your crew in New York.
Yeah. The guys I was influenced by.
Which is a bunch of piece of garbage.
Yeah.
All of them. Yeah. Every single one of them. So,
A cleaner piece of garbage. Yeah. I'm in the yard garbage that are just strode down the street. I'm in a bag on the corner that got put out.
Just nice and nice tied and tight. Up.
We're all pieces of garbage. Yeah. I'm just like, you know.
I'm a used condom, just like in the street with a needle stabbed right in the center.
You're just a raccoon just dug through it the night before. And I'm in a nice neighborhood. They pick up twice a week. We pay for it.
Who are the guys that you love in comedy? Who are the guys? Because I know, obviously, you love Regan. Huge fan of Regan.
Yeah,
your guy for a while, and he was super clean. But
Seinfeld was my first, but Regan was the guy. Regan was the first guy that I ever heard that I didn't understand how a guy could be that funny and not be the most famous human being on earth. That was the first time of my introduction into like a comedy where I'm like, I don't understand. Like, you know, I was just like, why is this guy not? Why did I? I mean, I was like a year or two into comedy when I found him out, and it was just like, how is he not literally a billionaire?
Which he probably is close to a billionaire. He's fucking rich. Regan's very, very rich.
No, it's all off stand-up.
Yeah, and, which is crazy. Actually, I'm gonna look up celebrity net worth. I want to see how much Brian Regan is worth while we're talking. But
so it's like, you know. But then when I went to move to New York, my influences changed. Like, that's the thing in comedies. I just was opened up to so many. Like, a world where you're going like, wow, man, there's like legitimate talent that like people don't know about. Like legitimate, like real talent, you know, because it's like watching sports and stuff like that. You're usually going to know the best. But in comedy, you're like, there's guys that would be, if you want to compare them to sports, would be NBA all-stars that no one has any idea who they are. And so, you know, it's like going there was Jay, Kurt Metzger. Those were probably my first two like guys that I watched where
like,
I was
goddamn,
like,
they're fucking killers.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, you know, and
7 million, his net worth.
Yeah,
nowhere near as much as I thought. Guys, I don't want to do this anymore. I quit. This is the last show, guys. I quit comedy. I
mean, he makes good money.
Actually, I think those celebrity net worth things are always pretty off.
Well, it's like he might even be. I that guy makes probably a couple million a year. So, but I don't know how long he's been making it, but he. So it's like, yeah, so those guys, Bill Burr is like, you know, like, I mean, I don't know if I would even name a clean comedian, really, like, that I would be influenced by. Like, I'm a big David Spade fan, which I know he's famous, but I don't think people really know about his stand-up, and I think his stand-up's unbelievable. Attell, obviously, was a big guy for all of us to watch, so it's like, those were, like, that's where I learned, which is the good thing that I think I was always happy that, like, to be a clean comedian, but I learned how to do comedy in New York. And I learned it from dirty guys. So it's like...
And it's kind of weird because you were one of the guys who... Because when I started, it was like I looked up to Big J, Kurt. And then like you and DeRosa were kind of like the dudes that were a little bit younger than them. That were like... And Vecchione was like one of those dudes. And then like you were the one guy that really kind of stood out. You came into the New York comedy scene with your own voice. It was like you weren't doing anybody. You know what I'm saying? I think we were all doing Dave Attell at one point. You know, everybody in our crew and our, like, we were all, like, we just kind of emulated Dave Attell in a weird way. You had your own thing going on. You started in Chicago.
Yeah.
And then you came to New York. Do you think that was a benefit, having an act, having, you know, maybe, I'm not, that's, I had to guess maybe 15 minutes at that time. That was,
I don't know if I had 15.
10 minutes that was polished.
Yeah.
Do you think that was a benefit or you think that was a detriment?
I don't think I honestly don't think I had that much time. I think when I was in Chicago, I was so new, too, like almost where you're too new. When I moved to New York and I started barking at Boston Comedy Club with Dustin, who truly did do it in a good way back then, is you would bark for stand up for stage time. And so like being around those clubs, that was the first time I ever learned how to get good. And I learned, and I was in front of a real audience, so I got to do the same 5 minutes, and I learned how to make that 5 minutes good. And that's like the thing.
I couldn't imagine you barking, by the way. I mean,
I was terrible. Because I'm not like, I'm like, hey, we got a comedy show, you know, if you want to come.
Did you get anybody in ever?
I think maybe, you know, if they were basically already going to go. Like they were already going to go pay full price. And I'm like, here's the ring, buy one, get one free. They're like, oh, all right, I guess that's good. We were going to just pay full price. But
I mean, back in the day, it's a little different now. There's very few clubs who do this now. There's a few rooms that still do it. Basically, you would go out and you would hand out flyers in front of the room in order to get 5-10 minutes of stage time at the end of the night. Sometimes they give you a buck or two per person that came in.
We never got paid, but I would get stage time at the end.
Yeah,
it was 7 days a week. I would go up every night.
Yeah, it was. It's when you're a brand new comic in New York, it's really, really worthwhile to do it. But it's like you are fucking fighting out of a hole, because the second this audience sees you, they're like, oh, this is a guy that was just handing out flyers.
Oh yeah,
in front of the club.
I waited at tables once.
It's hilarious.
At Boston, the server didn't show up, and I used to wait tables, so I knew how. So I waited the tables and then went up.
We were talking before about how comedy is such a sensitive art form. So now you have to dig yourself out of this hole. And usually you'd probably make a joke about it. Like, hey, guys, just you might recognize me from outside. Exactly. Just giving you your drinks. Yeah.
You almost have to do that.
It's so funny how in the beginning, comedy is so much harder. It just gets easier in this weird way. It gets harder in a weird way. Like, the industry gets harder to navigate, and you start to realize it's not just about being funny anymore. Yeah. But in the beginning, there's so much going against you. They give you the check spot. They give you a barker spot late night, super late at night. You don't have any jokes. You don't have the ability to make an audience laugh. And then the audience knows that you're not good and you're not a pro. Yeah. And you have to go, I'm going to start here and try to become a famous comedian.
And you're following, I mean, I had to follow, like, Chappelle was coming there at a point almost every night. This is last season of Chappelle Show. So, I mean, he's in the peak. Not that he's always been super famous, but, I mean, like, Ali, he is, like...
This is fucking...
This is it. This is, like, dude, he's the man. And, like, he's always been unreal.
I think he's retained that fame almost.
Oh, no, he's an A-list celebrity, but he's like his own, like, even A-list celebrities are like, if they see Chappelle, are like,
oh, it's Chappelle, God, yeah.
Like, so, but, like, you know, but this is, like, he's on TV at this time, yeah. Like, and it's like, I mean, Chappelle used to come in there every night, so I remember going up, like, you would stand out, so Chappelle would come in, and there'd be six people in the crowd. And that's the thing, too. I never performed in front of big crowds. It was always, I performed for one guy once. One guy. And we told, we don't want to do it. And he goes, I'm fine. I would like to watch it. And we're like, no, we do not. Please do not make us do this. And the guy's like, no, it's
good. He's just a weird pervert, like a trench coat, watching you guys suffer.
Just suffer. And we had to do the show in front of him. So, like, we had, like, and I remember Chappelle going up and, like, you'd have to follow him. Like, there'd be six people in the crowd. Chappelle would go in. You'd go outside and tell people, hey, there's Chappelle. Dave Chappelle's on stage. You can go for free. And people just walk by, and their plans change. They're going home. They're doing whatever. And
going to visit their aunt in the hospital. Yeah. They're going to work, whatever. It's like, that's it. My night is now Chappelle.
There's 80 people in there. One of the funniest parts was one time I told someone, I go, Dave Chappelle's on stage. It's free. Go in there and watch. And they go, I don't believe you. And, like, this is the Boston Comedy Club. Like, so you're standing outside. There's four steps and then a door with a window. I go, walk up those four stairs. Look in that window. If that's not Dave Chappelle, you walk back down these four stairs. And, like, by the way, we're outside a comedy club. So the idea, it's not like I'm, like, you know, at a library. Where they're like, I don't believe what's going on here. What trick are you trying to pull? And they did not believe me and would not go in.
They wouldn't walk up the steps even?
Walk up the stairs to check and then left. And those people miss seeing Dave Chappelle.
That's fucking hilarious.
But then you would go on after Dave Chappelle. So, like, you know, Chappelle would go up and then be like, all right, I'm out. Good night.
2 hours later.
2 hours later. And then, you know, now it's like 3 a.m.
40% of the audience just disappears immediately.
40?
80.
I mean, 80? I mean, dude, it's like literally 90. I mean, like, if you had six people in there, everybody leaves but those six people. And they just have to stay because I guess they didn't get their check. So, like, you're like, I would walk on stage and you just would do, like, that, you know, like, typical joke, like, thanks, Dave Chappelle, for opening for me tonight. Yeah. Like, something, whatever. You're just trying to, no one stays. No one cares about you. And, like, you just have to go up and try to do your comedy in front of, you know, an audience leaving, like, people leaving. And it was, you know, so it's like, I don't know, it's crazy. And that's how you learn how to do. But that's where I saw Jay and Kurt, and I would watch all those guys. And you know what? I would sound like them. I think my accent always helped hide a lot of, like, any influence I would have. So I think it did help. And the fact, like, maybe it's, like, I don't know, doing material that was, like, a different, like, in a way, being clean or whatever. Like, so, but I have a tape online you can see with Hannibal Buress hosting. That's how long ago it was. And I sound like Jay in that tape. And Metzger was a big one. Metzger, I mean, I would catch myself doing Metzger a ton. Like, and I would have to, like, and I, you know, there'd be times where I don't know if an audience would notice, or I don't know if even a comic would notice, but I could feel myself do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would write in the voice, as a young comic, I would write, like, when I'd write a joke, I would write it the way that you would write it, or I'd write it the way that Metzger would write it.
Yeah.
Or just, like, in my head, I'm writing it in that person's voice.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you even see it, like, early videos of me, I do Kurt Metzger so much. Like, I put my hand out in front of me, like, and I do, like, the Kurt Metzger, like, okay, I'm here to make you laugh. fucking goofy fucking thing he does. But it's funny, because I didn't notice it about you. You were one of the guys that were just very unique day one, where I was like, God damn it, there's nobody else like Nate. And I do think it is a little bit of an advantage to start when you're out of New York City, because I think for me, I started in New York. I will always be just a fucking open micer to a lot of these headliners that have been there for 20 years. I will never be anything, no matter how good I get, no matter how much, no matter how many credits I get, no matter how many times I've headlined, no matter what I do in comedy, I'm always going to be this young buck to these people. And I don't even know a way to kind of break out of that. And I feel like when you come in already, I don't think people really ever looked at you as like an open mic, or even though you really didn't have an act, I think immediately people saw you and thought you were funny. I met you very quickly when you moved to New York City, you know?
I think people did. I mean, I remember doing... I remember my first TV thing was CMT, Comedy Stages. It was in Nashville. And, you know, I mean, I did 7 minutes on CMT. Like, I did stand-up. And I was, it was 2006, maybe. Like, was it six? It was like four. I was like 4 or 5 years in or something. Maybe 4 years in. And I did the set on TV. And then I came back to New York. And I was, like... I was like trying to get a spot at the Village Lantern, and was told to bark for the spot. Where I'm like, you know, like, I just did TV. I give you, like, people might be like, well, it's CMT. It's like, but nowadays, like, the credits, like, you know what's funny is, like, the credits people use now are like, people are saying last comic, or they're saying whatever credits, where you're like, this ain't a thing. Like, you're not even like, no one's even seen this. I was at least on a network. Like, you know,
you did 7 minutes of material on a network.
On a network.
Whereas, like, people will go stand online and Last Comic Standing, and they'll use that as their credit.
Yeah. And, like, but it's so funny.
The internet is a great equalizer now.
Yeah.
Because you can't do that anymore.
No, yeah.
If you look at my resume, dude, if you look at your resume, you look like in 86, if I would just lay out your resume. Like, all right, this guy's poor. You got a mansion, a couple Ferraris. What is he? Would you teach Seinfeld how to teach him the ropes? But now it's like, you know, the internet, you can see how many Twitter followers you have. Yeah. It's completely quantified now. You can no longer bullshit how famous you are in this industry.
Well, with Twitter followers, you can't, you know.
Well, you can buy them, but now you can just Twitter. I Twitter audit people all the time. Go to twitteraudit.com, just put in their name, and you see how many fake Twitter followers they have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, everybody has fake Twitter followers, right?
Because but you see, if somebody has 10% fake, because that's just naturally what happens, or if somebody has 70% fake.
It's like.
I know a few names.
Yeah.
I won't name them on the show, but I know a few names of people that we know that have definitely purchased Twitter followers.
Yeah.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Uncomfortable.
Woo!
Oh, my God. I would much rather not. I would rather have no Twitter followers.
Yeah.
I'd rather just get rid of Twitter.
I have a thing with, like, being I'm not, like, blue checked, verified.
I want to. It will kill Big J if I can get verified before him. All I want to do is get verified before Big J. If you are a fan of the show.
Are you trying to get.
Yeah, I'm putting it out there.
See, I thought. I felt weird. Like, I thought, like, I was like, oh, I'm going to let it happen naturally. But it like bugs me to where I'm like, golly, can I get...
Oh, I haven't actively gone after it. I'm saying right now I'm going to be active.
Yeah.
Just, and it's not because I think I deserve to be verified. I've got 6,000 Twitter followers. Yeah. I know it would murder Big J Okerson. Yeah, open it. I know it would murder Big J Okerson's side if I was verified before him. And I've seen people with like 2,000 Twitter followers verified.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's who you know. That's, I think, the thing. If you're a fan of the show and you're a Gomite, or if you know anybody who works at Twitter, please hit me up, email me, lewis@gomezcomedy.com, and help me get verified before Big J. Big J, he's such a bad person, guys. You have to realize this.
But you can't, but don't like at Big J, too.
No. Don't let
Big
know.
J know.
It's got to be known. It's got to be a private thing.
We're already
thing.
Assuming Big J will never listen to this podcast.
No, he will. Are you kidding me? Yeah. He might listen if somebody says, hey, dude, they talked about you at the 45-minute mark.
Yeah, don't say that.
All right, so Cole, here's the thing. You're a real ass dude, Nate, and I've put a few people in this category, not just being real ass dudes, but just kind of throwing the rule book out the window and not taking the traditional route of things. I had Giannis Papas on the show recently. I talked to him about it, him moving to Miami and making the decision to go to that TV show. Real ass dude move, said, fuck it, I don't care about the rules. Still went out and got a half hour special while he was living in Miami, which is literally, it just doesn't happen, okay? Ari Shaffir, this motherfucker never did a minute on Comedy Central and went out and got 2 hour long specials and a TV show. Never even did anything on Comedy Central. Never did any of these he was never on any of these lists. Never a dude that was even considered for anything. And then just got enough fans one day and said, fuck it, I don't need you. I have 100,000 Twitter followers. I am my own business. And then everybody else just followed suit. Very real ass move. Loved it, okay? You recently just purchased a house, which I'm sitting in right now, fucking gorgeous house, right outside of Nashville, Tennessee, which is your home area, and it's not the traditional move. It's not typically you have to, if you're a comic, you have to live in New York, you have to live in LA, you got to pick one of those two cities, or you're a fucking weirdo that's living in the woods somewhere and you're whatever.
Yeah.
But you said, fuck it, dude. You said, I want to own a really nice piece of property and I want to be able to do what I want to do. Just talk to me a little bit about that decision. Why'd you decide to buy the house in Nashville as opposed to slumming it out in the cities?
I've been gone from here for 13 years. So I was in Chicago, New York, was majority, and then LA for two. I haven't really said a lot. I've tried to keep it under wraps that I have moved to Nashville.
Fucked this one up, guys.
I know.
Edit.
And cut.
And then come
back.
Scene.
And then we just come back to going, so LA is beautiful. I mean, look at the weather right now, dude. It's like, I love living in Hollywood. I just make up. So, no. But I told you we could talk about it. Like, I don't know. It's like, because I get half and half where the truth of it is that I thought, at first I was like, you know what, I'm going to move back to Nashville. I have a daughter. Our entire family lives here. It's easier for them. I go on the road so much that it's brutal to fly out of LA. I was just leaving them out there by themselves. It was almost pointless. I wasn't even in LA enough to get everything I should get out of it. And I did get stuff out of it. I was there for 2 years. So I feel like I've done it long enough. And I was like, you know what? I think I can do it. And I just thought, I'm not going to say anything about it. I was like, I'll just move and then not tell anybody. And even though I think we're talking about it now, you don't have to go. If you listen to this, don't go tell everybody I'm moving.
Nate's just assuming we don't have a lot of listeners. That's what's happening.
I know the industry will not hear this. No, but it's really for the industry. Like, in the fact that, like, the industry's not going to hear it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not making it a big deal. I'm not making big announcements. I didn't, like, big Facebook, Twitter, like, hey, I'm moving to Nashville, I'm out, blah, blah. I just did it. And I go back to L.A. very often. I have a room I stay in out there when I go out there. I've got a buddy. And so it's like I was able to have that. And then now that I go out with my daughter being here, is like she has a life that's like, you know, it's enough to make you cry. Like I'm so happy with, like, she goes to all these birthday parties and she's her best friends, her cousin.
Well, your parents are here. Laura's parents are here. You have a whole family unit and a family structure here. And, you know, me personally, I have no family and I know how hard it is to raise a kid on your own.
Yeah.
It's almost depressing.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, you want to enjoy every part of life. You want to watch your kid be happy and have family and friends. And it's like, you're like, dude, I'm just, because of my own selfish reasons, I'm sticking my family in this area. Yeah. Were you concerned that people were like, oh, Nate's just given up?
Yeah, yeah. I'm always very concerned about that. I'm still concerned. I mean, that's why I was like, even like, at first, reluctant to even talk about it. Like, even though people are knowing. I mean, like you
said. People hear about it.
People hear about it. So it's like, and like I said, like even though we're talking about it now, I still don't think it's going to be like, everybody's not going to be like, going to know completely. And there's people still think I lived in New York, you know, that no idea I even moved to Los Angeles. And that was, I was very known. So, you know, I go on the road so much and stuff like that. And if I need to go back out to LA, I have a place to go back out there. And I will, you know, if I had to move back out there, I told my wife, is like, look, if I move back and I feel like I'm slipping and like I'm losing steam or whatever, then we might have to move back.
I mean, but you're you're doing the Tonight Show next week again. Your seventh?
Eight.
Your eighth late night appearance. You are releasing your hour-long Comedy Central special. It's going to be premiering May 2nd. A very busy night in the world of sports entertainment.
Use the hashtag Mayweather Pacquiao. Mayweather Pacquiao.
Same night. The biggest fight in history.
The biggest fight. Literally the biggest fight in history. And maybe one of the last. Because who's coming behind him that would ever draw numbers like
that's
that?
That's it. No, it's probably one of the... It's the last
big...
It could
be the end of boxing.
The last big boxing match of all time. Guys, be there. I'm not even going to watch any special now.
I'm not going to watch my special. There's no way I'll watch it.
But that's the thing, you're not slipping. You're doing, it reminds me to be honest, you're doing better than ever. And I looked at it, it was a very baller move when, like I was talking to Dave Smith about it. Very baller move. It reminds me of like Doug Stanhope. Doug Stanhope's the one famous guy who like doesn't, I think lives in Arizona or something. Or just,
Zach Galifianakis is another one. He lived in North Carolina.
Yeah, these guys that are just, they've gotten famous enough where they go like, yeah, I've made it to the point where I can just choose to live where I want to live. And it's inspiring for me because for me, like, I don't know if I necessarily want to always live in New York or LA. I think I want to own a nice big piece of property. I mean, this fucking house, I don't want to suck your dick on the show, but whip it out, dude. That's the end of every real ass podcast. I just start blowing my yes. It's a really good benefit, guys. Some places give you coffee and beer. Get a nice, good blowjob from the real ass dude on the real ass podcast. But no, it really is. It's this beautiful house, big backyard. I mean, this is the fucking American dream. The American dream is not living in a two-bedroom apartment on top of fucking Puerto Ricans and Asians on the other side of you. That's the American nightmare, if you ask me. And I think that's what every comic kind of puts themselves through. And I think times are changing. We have the internet available to us. We have, you can literally, you don't need to go to a big city to put out a piece of content. You don't need to work with a video production team in New York City in order to put out something that is high quality content anymore. Technology is cheap enough. There's enough talented people around the country that you can be a professional entertainer and live almost anywhere. I do think you do need to pass a certain threshold, though. Like, I couldn't do it. You jokingly say, why don't you just move out to Tennessee? I couldn't do that right now. I don't have the road work. I don't have the demand for me as an entertainer. I don't have the presence within the industry. It would be like a nail in my coffin. But for you, I think it's a smart move, and I really do commend you for it. I think it's fucking badass.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, so far, there's been no complaints. I've gone to Los Angeles more than I've ever, even in my life. It's just hilariously, the second I moved, I had to go out there, then like, so much. And so it's like, yeah, but you know what? I just suck it up, and like, those are the things I have to do. Like, I have to sometimes fly to LA. I'll go for, you know, whatever reason I need to go. I don't know. I agree. It's like, I'm on the road too much anyway that, like, I wasn't even there when I was there. So it is easier to kind of be fine in and out of here. My goal is to be able to go back to New York and, like, a lot more now because I'm a lot closer to New York.
Yeah, you're substantially closer to New York.
So, I'm like, the goal is to be able to go to New York for 3 days and just do sets and, like, just, you know, work on my act, like, that way. And then, you know, if I got to go to L.A., worst case scenario, I have to buy a flight day of, and I fly to L.A. in the morning.
And that's how much of a baller you are. You can afford to do that. Boom.
Well, it's flight because to L.A. Night. Yeah, and it's never going to happen. Yeah, but it's like, you know, but and that's the worst case scenario, really.
Yeah.
It's like you're out $500, but the money we save.
I mean, the money you save per year, if you put the money you save per year on rent versus what you're paying on your mortgage out here, just put that money away per year. I mean, you can go to LA twice a month, back and forth, easily, I'm sure.
I can say that my wife's job, she makes $400 more a month just because we don't pay California taxes.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
So that's just flat out. That was just a move. Was like, that's the difference. So yeah, but look, you know, yeah. I mean, I think I have done it a long time. I think I did. I always have a fear that I'm gonna just fall off and like be not thought about and stuff like that. But if I can just stay, you know, if you stay on top of it, consciously stay on top of it. If I keep building, keep trying to write new jokes. If I ever feel like it's happening, I've made big moves. I moved to Chicago. I've moved to New York. I've moved to Los Angeles. I'm not afraid to move. So if I ever feel like, you know what, I'm dropping a little bit.
If you need to leave your family, you'll do it.
If that's what I have to do, that's what I have to
do. You heard it here first in the Realist Podcast. We're going to wrap up here in just a minute. Got a couple questions from the fans. I put it out on Facebook and Twitter. Said I got Nate Bargatze in studio. Mike Solano wants to know, how do you juggle both comedy? How do you juggle comedy? How do you both juggle comedy with families? I get it. He's asking both of us. Specifically, having parts of your act that your partner's family may not agree with or find funny, or if you have material about your partner or family. All right, so he's saying, how do you juggle both having a comedy career and a family? And then also, does your wife or chick get pissed off about some of your material? You have a lot of your act, even before you had a baby, it was really about married life, being a newlywed. Yeah. That was like a very, very big part of who you were as a comic, and now a lot of it's about the baby. Do you ever deal with any pushback from the family? Like, what the fuck? Why are you talking about that?
I think at the beginning, I feel like sometimes like they could, like, you know. I mean, her parents are cool. I honestly, I like both. I like her parents. I don't think her mom likes my comedy. But I don't think it's, like, not the jokes. I honestly think she, like, I'm just a low energy. Like, I'm just not a...
She's just way... She's like Kevin Hart. She likes a nice like, fucking, like, you know, like, high energy black act.
So, you know, I don't know. Yeah, they could at the beginning. But, like, you know, it's like you just don't talk to them. Like, why would I... You know, it's like I don't always talk to them about stuff like that. And but they've been super supportive and, like, stuff like that. And it was funny on how to juggle it. You're talking about, too, like, how you juggled, like, doing comedy. Because I get that question, like, it's about being married and stuff like that. And, like, this is, like, in a bad way, this sounds bad. Even though I've made moves, like, now, this move is completely for my wife and daughter. Us moving to Nashville, it's the first unselfish thing I've done in 13 years.
But it's because you could afford to be unselfish now. You have
to be.
That's
the only reason.
You have to be selfish in the beginning. You have to.
That's, like, without putting comedy before your family, you kind of got to put comedy before your family.
Yeah.
And that's like, and like, honestly, to make it, that's the only way, dude. I like, the only way is like, it sounds bad where like, now I can say no to a couple things because you know what? I don't want to go there for that money. And like, cause you know, I haven't been home. But that being said, is like, I'm going out as hard as I can right now. Cause I'm trying to give them something that they would never have. I'm trying to give them, you know, this move here was the first unselfish thing I've done, honestly, for my fam. Like, that, it's always been pure selfish. I moved on to
I mean,
New York,
not pure selfish, because, look,
but
you,
it's selfish.
You justify it, because you say, hey, look, dude, everything I'm doing...
I'm trying to be the best.
I'm trying to succeed. I'm trying to...
You have to be obsessed with comedy.
If you weren't selfish, quote-unquote, for those first few years, and you're one of the examples that I use. I mean, your fucking wife is awesome, dude. Look, I wish my chick was as supportive as your chick, because your chick let you do comedy. She didn't say, hey, dude, you got to go wait tables every day. You got to, like, your chick said, hey, dude, I know it's going to be tough. I know it's going to be a financial struggle in the beginning, but she let you go and be a comic. Whereas I think my chick has a little bit more, like, worry in her, like, well, where's this going to come from? Where's this going to come from? You know, I think I feel a little bit more pressure on the back end to, like, I don't, like I said, it's just a difference in my chick's obsessed with, like, how we're gonna fucking pay the bills in 10 years, not even just today, like, where it's gonna come from in 10 years. So I think it makes it really, really difficult. But I use you as an example. It's like, your chick was so supportive of you and let you be a comic that I think you kind of need that type of person. If you don't have a woman that's with you that is completely wholeheartedly supportive, be alone.
Yeah, well, you have to do it. She has been supportive, and the thing that I did too is I let her know, is like, this is what we're doing. You know, it's like the big help was when we did get married. I worked a couple side jobs here and there. But then she got a job in New York and was making like more money than she'd have made in Nashville.
Yeah.
And so it was like enough that like, you know, we could live off that. So the first little bit, I mean, it's taken me so long.
I know your numbers, dude. I know your numbers. It's so funny because I remember, I won't say anything, but I remember, I'll say this. The first year you broke 20K. I remember that.
Yeah.
And I remember how long ago it was. I remember how excited you were.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And it's so funny, the process. I remember thinking a few years ago, going like, holy shit, dude. It took Nate that long to break 20K. Like,
a long time.
A long time. And yeah. I was really like, fuck it. It was almost like, that was probably when I was closest ever to quitting comedy. Yeah. When I was like, dude, I don't even see that level in sight.
I don't think I made really money. I mean, I think I've maybe the past two or three years is the only time I've made like where it's like, you know, it's like I'm very happy, like you're making money and you're like, but like, I mean, you know, before that it always moved up. I always went forward. But yeah, I mean, dude, I was like, it was like making nothing. Like I was never making money in the clubs. I never made like.
If you had to have a day job during those times though, how much harder do you think it would have made the job?
Well, I did at the beginning. I mean, I worked for FedEx I drove trucks. When I first moved to New York, I delivered for FedEx and I drove the trucks in Manhattan and Queens and Brooklyn, like with an old map before GPS. But I knew that's the job I would do if this all comes crashing down. And so I did that and I would work. I would go like that. That was hard because I would like get there at 6 a.m. Sometimes I'd get done at like 10 a.m. Sometimes I wouldn't get done until 9 p.m. So I couldn't do that anymore because I was like that. I can't even do comedy at night. And then I started doing a job where I would load trucks at FedEx and I would just like load them because that you worked from like 5 a.m. to like 10 a.m. and that was it. And I would bark and I would stay up and I would just stay awake and go to FedEx.
You'd go sleep all day.
And then sleep all day. So I would just go to Boston Comedy Club, bark, and then go at 5 a.m. to FedEx and load the trucks, go home at 10 a.m., sleep, go back.
How much would it affect you now if you had to go? Because I was saying that recently. It's like I couldn't go back to having a day job. It would be impossible.
It would be. I miss, you know what, I do miss the structure. There's times where I want a job. I don't want a day job, but I want like a
comedy job.
A comedy job, like something that makes me go at like 10 a.m. Because you do miss not having the structure. It's hard. It's very hard to not, I mean, at the very beginning, I would, you know, it's like when you weren't working, it's like I would stay up till 6 a.m. every single night. And like, not because you're partying, you know, it's like, it's just because you would be out late and then you go home and then your brain's going and then you're like, I mean, I stay up till 2. You know, but like it's like back then you'd be 6, you'd sleep all day. And like, it's just, that's the way it was, you know?
All right, real quick. Actually, Mike Solana relates on the same subject. He wants to know, what was your last normal job?
It was the, you know, delivering for FedEx. That was the most, I did like temp work, and stuff. I've moved people. I would like, if my last normal job is a job that I would be doing, I would be delivering.
You'd be a district manager at UPS right now.
I'd be doing something like that. As FedEx, when I delivered, we delivered FedEx in New Jersey. I did it so, because one day we had to go to New Jersey to do it because they needed people. And that was back into like neighborhoods like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it so fast. I did it faster than anybody's ever done it. That's what they got
to
tell me.
It's your claim to fame.
They were blown away. They were blown away. How fast I did it.
All right, Brandon Dorton wants to know, I'm not being a peckerhead by asking this, but is it hard to make ends meet sometimes? When I saw Bobby and Scopo a while back, it was a sold-out show, but then I saw a list, in parentheses, great show in North Carolina, and there were only 3 to 4 real fans there.
Yeah.
He killed, but most of the folks walked right past him when the show was over. It really was surreal for me to actually meet him, hang out for a few, and I bought his CD, but he probably took a hit traveling that far and not making that much money. Love you guys. You're also gracious to your fans. Bobby was extremely nice to me and my friends. Signed our copies of Cheat and took pics with us. Hope to see you and Nate some more soon. Yeah, dude, it's all levels, man. We just started talking about, you know, money in it. And look, the truth is, no, typically, if you're headlining a show, you're not taking a hit. The guarantee was there.
So, yeah, but the flying stuff's great. But, like, typically, I would say the bottom, the average or whatever of a headlining is $1,200.
Yeah.
That's usually, like, and, like, for featuring, it's usually, like, $250 a show for headlining. $100 featuring. That's a good club. That's a club that where they should be. Look, there's plenty that pay way less than that.
Yeah.
And then gradually as you go up, your money goes up.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. If you start headlining, that's there. And you look, if you saw Joe or anybody else, here's the thing, man. A lot of these clubs on the road, they're not just booking a guy that can draw. They're booking a guy that can entertain their audience so they come back.
And gang people, yeah.
Yeah, and that's most of the time.
Take hits. But I think that people, you
clubs
definitely...
Clubs take a hit.
No, clubs take a hit. But no, comics can too. Like, I mean, look, if you go in North Carolina, depending on where he flies... if you're not going to like Charlotte or to like something like crazy like that, I mean, you could be $600 into a ticket. I'm not saying Joe, I don't know what Joe made like on that, but like there's times you could go and you're spending half your money on the ticket.
Yeah, well, the gamble is then if you have merchandise or if you have things that you can sell, or you even looked at here, I was saying this to you earlier today, and we'll wrap up here in a second, and we'll kind of end on this point. But every fan that you have, like let's say there was only four fans there at that show, every fan that you have is worth X amount of dollars. They refer other friends, they buy your merchandise, they buy your tickets, they buy your albums, they support all of your shit, they go to your YouTube page, they subscribe to you on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter. At the end of their lifespan as a fan, there's a number value assigned to each person that fucking calls themselves a Gomite or a fucking or whatever whoever you love. So yeah, every time I do a show, I'd like to think two or three people, if there's 100 people in that crowd, two or three people are going to walk out and they're going to remember my name and they're going to go home and they're going to look me up. And even if I'm being, not even making that much money on that show, those people will hopefully turn in to more and more and more and more money. So you can't really be short-sighted in this business. If it's about the money and comedy, this is just the wrong fucking game.
No, you can't ever, yeah.
Because there's no money in the beginning.
There's no money at the beginning. Yes, you do hope to make money, but like if you don't ever get in it for money. I mean, I rarely even sometimes even know what I never even knew what I would be getting paid, ever.
Well, that's what I'm starting to get into now, where it's like I'm getting just checks in the mail like randomly. Yeah. Like I don't even know. Like I don't really pay attention now as much.
Yeah.
And you're like, I just hope at the end of the year this ends up being in the green. You know. Last question from the fans. Lionheart wants to know what cum tastes like.
I mean, you probably know.
Salty. All right. Nate, dude, thanks so much for doing the Real Ass Podcast. This is the second Real Ass Podcast exclusive. Obviously. There's been, 40 episodes of the show, but this is the exclusives of the one-on-ones. We're just, interview style.
Who's talk the first
shit.
One?
Big J. Yeah, you're the second one, buddy. So, look, obviously follow Nate on Twitter, at Nate Bargatze. Go to his website, iamnate.com. His hour-long special, Full Time Magic, will be coming out this May 2nd at midnight, guys. So set your DVRs.
Eastern.
11 Central. Set your DVRs.
Comedy Central.
Tell your fucking friends. That's the most important thing, man. If you want to support us, tell your friends about us. If you're hanging out with a bunch of buddies, set their DVRs. Go home. If you're at your buddy's place, say, like, dude, watch this guy's special because he's one of the funniest fucking comics working today. And also you have an album out, Yelled At By A Clown, which you guys can purchase on iTunes for just $10.
Yeah.
Yeah, guys, go buy Nate's album, Yelled At By A Clown, which is an unbelievable album, unbelievable piece of comedy. And that is it, man. We will check you next week on the Real Ass Podcast. Peace.
That's all, folks.